And the second matter of three matters for oral argument this morning, A231227, the welfare of the children of MMM parent. Judge Johnson joins myself, Judge Wheelock as well, for this proceeding. We do ask counsel, because we are recording and live streaming, that you do make sure to identify yourself for the record when you approach the podium to begin your comments. You'll see the clock, of course, there you can keep an eye on, and there's a button somewhere on the front face, I believe, of the podium there so that you can lower it or increase the height for your comfort as well. So with that, counsel for appellant, if you want to approach, identify yourself, you may then begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brooke Baskow-Warg, and I represent the appellant father, AAA, in this appeal of the orders terminating his parental rights. Father asks this court to reverse those orders and remand to the district court for further proceedings. This case presents two issues. The first is whether the service by publication was reasonably calculated to reach father such that he had proper notice of the termination of parental rights proceedings. This issue implicates father's due process rights, as proper and reasonable notice is a fundamental component of due process. The second issue is whether the department proved by clear and convincing evidence that it provided reasonable efforts to father. This court may reverse on either or both of these issues and remand to the district court for further proceedings. First, regarding the notice. Generally, under the rules of juvenile protection procedure, service of a termination of parental rights petition and summons must be accomplished through personal service. However, the district court is allowed to authorize service by other means, including through publication, if the petitioner has filed a written statement of diligent efforts to locate the person being served. This court has determined that service by publication is sufficient to confer personal jurisdiction where it is not reasonably possible or practicable to give more adequate warning. However, service by publication must be reasonably calculated to reach the interested party. We're not challenging the district court's decision to authorize service by publication in this case. Rather, we are challenging the decision to publish the summons and petition in a Minneapolis newspaper as not reasonably calculated to inform father of the action. I'd also note that this is arguably due to the fact that it appears the district court failed to comply with the applicable rule, which provides that the court has to approve the location of the publication. I did not see anywhere in the record, including the order authorizing the publication, that the court actually addressed where the publication should occur.
Did the county's motion specify a location?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The motion, the affidavit of diligent efforts, and the order for publication are one in the same document. My review of that document shows that it includes father's last known address, including, record of previous addresses as well, his phone number, and then a statement at the bottom, the order that the court signed off and authorized on that notice of publication based on the affidavit. It also did, I would also note that the order requires that a copy of the summons and petition be mailed to any last known address. My review of the record, and there's a chance that I missed something, but my review of the record, I did not see that there was any affidavit or any other indication that any sort of mailing was made with that petition and summons to father's last known address, so I am not sure that that occurred as well. I would note also that while the rule under Rule 16 that addresses publication does not specifically require that mailing, Rule 5302, I believe it is, 5302 Subdivision 3 does note that notice sent by certified mail to the last known address must be sent at least 20 days before the hearing. So I believe when we read those rules together, there is a requirement of that mailing, which was not complied with here. The facts and the record.
By the way, am I correct, counsel, that the attorney who was present at the default hearing did object on the jurisdiction, on the service issue?
The attorney at the hearing, my recollection from the transcript is that the attorney at the hearing objected to the default and asked that there be time to cure that default and for father to submit a voluntary termination of his parental rights. I don't recall that the attorney at the hearing argued that the service was insufficient.
And your authority for the error, you were quoting it, is the reasonable, that it would reasonably reach the recipient, I guess we will call him at this point, but generally. But what do we make of the fact that if it's not in the motion, but also what in the, if there's no information presented to a judge of a particular location with a particular publication, how would we know, or how would the judge know, as we're looking at what the judge knew or didn't know, as to whether there's error? If you follow what I'm getting at, I mean, we hear a lot about Illinois, but it's a big state. So isn't it really a matter of calculating what would be more reasonable than the one that was used, I guess, is the argument you're making? But what was presented, and there was nothing presented, I assume, to the judge to consider something.
All we have is the affidavit of reasonable efforts submitted by what appears to be the department social worker on the case. That is all we have. Of course, the rule does provide that the court needs to approve of the location for that. So there was an error there in that perhaps more evidence needed to be submitted as to where father's location was so that they could serve him. Of course, that is the reason for publication. We don't know exactly where this individual is. But even so, when we serve by publication, it needs to be reasonably calculated under the circumstances to reach that individual.
Counsel, under, in terms of the service that was given, so they sent the mail out. What would have been more reasonable, I guess, is one of my questions, in terms of they knew that he at least had come back to Minnesota at various points in time. They did not have another state. They were, you know, he was on the road, right, and he was moving. What would have been more reasonable than a publication in a Minnesota paper?
I think based on the facts and the circumstances in this case, that Illinois or somewhere in Illinois, his probably where his last known address was, probably would have been more reasonable than Minnesota in this case. If you look at the testimony at the admit-deny hearing, which was the default hearing, the caseworker says on page 17 of that I believe he's no longer been in the state since December of 2021. It's my understanding he's been through Wisconsin and Illinois quite a bit, and that's where I believe he resides currently. I understand that is he's currently residing in Illinois, which, and then she goes on to explain that that's made it difficult to meet face-to-face.
Perhaps you can help me, or opposing counsel can help me then. In the record, I thought that there was some indication that the last known address in Illinois, in fact, they got returned mail from it, that it was not his address, and that they did have information that he had been maybe stopped over in a few other different states based on his job. So with that type of information, I'm still struggling to see how Illinois would have been the appropriate better choice.
Yeah, and I think that, again, looking at the record as a whole with that last known address, with a number of his other addresses that are provided in that affidavit, as well as looking at the information about where many of the services took place. In the petition for termination of parental rights, it acknowledges that many of the services were offered in the state of Illinois, and in many times in the Chicago area. Also at the hearing, the The caseworker testified as such. Many of those services were offered in the state of Illinois. She, as I just explained, acknowledged at the hearing that she believed his current place of residence was in the state of Illinois and not in Minnesota. So it seems at a minimum that it's more likely that he was in the state of Illinois than in the state of Minnesota at the time of publication.
Is there anything in the record that shows that he was, in fact, in Illinois?
Anything in the record that shows, in fact, he was in the state of Illinois, except for the only thing I can point to, but this came after, would be the IFP where he includes his address, the affidavit for IFP.
And another question I have is, you've said that there was a potentially another error by the district court because it didn't approve of the location for the publication.
Correct.
If in its findings, and I think I saw this in its order, it says that father was served by publication on these dates, and it identifies, the dates that it went out on, and it was aware that the court was aware that the publication was this Minnesota paper. Can we infer that the district court, in fact, approved of that publication location?
I believe... Yes, but that happened after the fact. And I don't know that having approval after the fact when we've already reached the point of a default proceeding when the parent has not shown up can be sufficient when the rule seems to suggest that that needs to be approved before the service by publication is made. And practically speaking, that makes the most sense, right? We need to have a court sign off and say, all right, this is where it makes the most sense to serve him based on the circumstances and based on the information before me, before we actually make that service by publication. Otherwise, affirming that or... saying that is okay after the fact doesn't seem to make much sense in the practical sense when we're looking at the purpose of the rule and the requirement that it needs to be reasonably calculated to reach that individual. So even if that is the case, I don't believe that that is sufficient under the circumstances of this case and based on the rule and the applicable case law as detailed in my brief.
Thank you. Would you acknowledge that the attorney in the district court had an opportunity to object to the publication at the hearing, but didn't do so?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is correct. I would...
Is this properly preserved, this specific issue?
Sure, and I do believe that opposing counsel did make that very argument in her brief. I would point to the non-precedential TRT decision, which was cited in my reply brief. In that case, it was also addressing a notice issue, and this court decided that the issue was properly before the court because while it needed to look to the legal question of was that service or was that notice actually proper, it first needed to look at those findings and whether there was clear error when the district court determined that the parent was properly served. I believe that this court can take that same approach here, look at the findings where in this case the district court said, yes, the father was properly served, he had notice by publication, and from there reached the legal question of whether that service by publication was actually sufficient.
So is the legal authority for that Rule 21? I know you've cited Rule 21 with respect to the second issue you've raised today, the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the reasonable efforts. But with respect to the first issue, I don't know. Does that sufficiency of the evidence rule apply to the issue of service?
I think if we are first...
Which essentially is an issue of personal jurisdiction. But.
That is correct. And again, I would point to the TRT case, which seems to have analyzed it sort of in the way that I was explaining and first looking at that finding of the district court and then getting to the legal element of was that sufficient.
I don't think TRT cited any authority for that point, as I recall. That's why I'm asking you for the underlying authority.
Sure, and you may be correct, Your Honor. The underlying authority for...
For the notion that the sufficiency of service may be addressed even without being specifically challenged in the district court.
Sure. And Your Honor, I agree. I don't believe that the TRT decision squarely provided any sort of legal authority other than providing its own reasoning based on the clear error standard that this court employs when looking at findings of fact. But certainly, I believe there is a sufficiency of the evidence in making that finding, right? Do we have sufficient evidence to support the fact that he was properly served? In this case, I don't know that we do, and that is a legal question.
And that is a finding in the final order?
That he was properly served? Yeah, that he was served by publication and that he received notice. That was a finding in the order, and I can find...
I can find it, too.
Okay.
I note TRT was an order opinion, which is quite often... It contains abbreviated reasoning, but...
Yes, Your Honor.
In addition to being non-precedential, it's also an order opinion.
Yes, and I would point to it for its persuasive value here, understanding that it is not precedential in this case, or in any case. I see my time is just about up, so I'm happy to answer any other questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may approach, and when ready, identify yourself and begin.
May it please the court, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing Hennepin County Human Services, excuse me, and counsel. I intend primarily to address the service issue. I don't mean to waive any arguments, and certainly I'm happy to answer any questions, particularly regarding reasonable efforts. It is the department's position, as we describe in our brief, that service was effective in this case. Under the rules of 5203 subdivision 3, the court serves and the court may serve by publication. So the court did order publication and service was done in a Minnesota paper that is authorized. The record was not developed here because this challenge was not presented to the district court. But I think that abuse of discretion in the court's proceedings apply, and given the facts of this specific case, even if the standard is the standard in the electromagnetic case that appellant relies upon, which is reasonably calculated to reach the recipient, it's met in this case because it is a Minnesota action. The appellant was well aware that it's a Minnesota action. Very crucially, the children in this matter are in Minnesota. The permanency proceeding was connected to the CHIPS proceeding, which was in place at the time the permanency proceeding happened and is ongoing. An appellant had appointed counsel in the ongoing proceeding. So all of that, combined with the fact that we did not know where appellant's actual residence was, where he physically was at the time of the hearing, and at the time the court ordered publication, means that a Minnesota paper was appropriate. I think also relevant to that is the fact that there was a hearing, so the default hearing was in April. There was a hearing, I believe it was in February, where there was a discussion that service by publication was anticipated to be the route that appellant was going to be served. There were multiple opportunities to develop any questions prior to going forward with the default, any questions regarding service. I think also...
Was counsel for father, was that kind of the end hearing, last hearing in the CHIPS case when there was envisioning a petition, or had the petition, this February hearing you're talking about?
I believe the petition had been filed, but there had not been any effective service at that point. And so there was discussion that publication would be going forward. I'm not actually 100% certain about that, but I believe that it was.
He had counsel during the child protection process?
Yes, I don't know when he was appointed counsel, if it was at the very first hearing, but he did have counsel throughout the process, and counsel continued through to today, essentially, but counsel continued to be active in his case. And it is accurate that in April, counsel objected to the default at that April hearing, April 2023, and counsel said, referred to the fact that counsel had been in relatively recent contact with appellant, and that she believed there had been some discussions and she essentially wanted more time. So all of that indicates appellant was aware of what was going on with this action. The social worker also testified to some contact relatively close to the hearing making arrangements so that appellant could take part as a Zoom hearing if that was permitted, things like that. So it's real clear that appellant was aware of the ongoing child protection action as well as the fact that permanency proceedings. Also, it's there are repeated points in the child protection process where parents or other parties involved in a case get notice that a permanency proceeding will happen. So it's I think it's within the context of this particular case, it's really clear that the permanency petition was there, that appellant had full opportunity to be aware of it, and that appellant knew that this action was going on in Minnesota. So it's really different from the 1980s case Electromagnetic that appellant is relying upon for creating that standard. I would also note that the issue, I mean, as I guess I've referred to it before, but the issue of residence and where appellant was not before the court for purposes of the service or jurisdiction. The social worker did testify to thinking that as far as she knew, the appellant was last in Illinois. That was connected to providing services. There were attempts to provide services, but there was also a gap of at least 6 months that there had been not any contact with the appellant by the department where the social worker was unable to provide services. So that comment about the fact that the social worker thought that perhaps that he lived in Illinois or had last resided in Illinois was not dispositive or not particularly helpful in resolving the issue about where he lived. Again, even I don't think that's fully dispositive on its own. I think we have to look at the totality of the facts before the court. At the time, the court decided that service was effective, sufficient that personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction existed, and the court could go forward with the default. So, and I think there's no abuse of discretion there on all of that.
You agree, I think I saw that in your briefing, too, the characterization of the objection was not on the sufficiency of the service, but simply to allow some time because there had been contact to try perhaps, so the objection was to a default hearing, but not on the basis of sufficiency, just to allow time because of that recent contact.
I guess, of course, we don't know what was in counsel's mind, but that's what was presented to the court, yes. When you say the objection, if you're meaning by appellant's counsel at trial, yes, that is what happened.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I would, in addition to noting that the service by publication had been contemplated and discussed, and again, there were those multiple opportunities, I would just finally note that service is different from jurisdiction. I think we're talking about due process, right? And subject matter jurisdiction is a threshold due process issue. What we're talking about is whether or not the service is effective here. And so that goes to abuse of discretion. And abuse of discretion is looking at the entire totality of the circumstances before the court. That it's not on just the simple issue of that standard of reasonably calculated. So it's whether or not in the totality of the circumstances of this case, whether or not service was effective here. And it is our position that it was. And I do note finally that child protection proceedings are unique in that the district court is very active throughout the proceedings, right? The court has a significant oversight of the departments of the social service agency's work, has a lot to do in terms of the procedures. Court, unlike most other civil cases, the court does the service. So the court was very active here, and I think that needs to be taken into account. We would be in a different circumstance if there had been specific facts presented to the court, if there had been an effective post-trial motion, something like that. But we don't have any of those things. And so then I think we need to take the record and the court's decision that service was effective as being sufficient. There's nothing directly counter to that. So I think that that's, based on that, there is no error and there's no relief due on that basis. Unless the court has any other questions, I would just briefly talk about reasonable efforts. It is our contention that the reasonable efforts is waived. That was not presented. The reasonable efforts argument is waived. It was not presented to the district court. The default proceedings, I think, properly just took evidence in support of the petition. That's what the default rule allows for. Any error or any sort of waiver would happen by not presenting any arguments either at that point, but more importantly, by asking to reopen the default, by developing a reasonable arguments issues after the fact, or asking for relief from the district court. And appellant did not do any of those things. And so I think that it is a waived argument. It has not been presented to the district court and is therefore not really susceptible to review at this point. However, even if the court gets to that, it is clear that from the evidence presented to the district court, that the agency made reasonable efforts to provide services to help appellant get into the place of parenting his children. He was in Minnesota at one point early on in the case. He discussed with the social worker what the agency's concerns were. There's no evidence that he objected to those concerns. He engaged in some services. They were primarily in Illinois, but he did engage in some services, had some contact. The social worker did follow up with him and follow up with agencies in Illinois attempting to provide services, help him to identify what was going on. Most importantly, the department attempted to facilitate contact between appellant and the children. He offered him visitation. He knew where the children were. There's evidence in the record that he had independent abilities to contact the children directly in their foster home. If he wanted to, the department was willing to set up virtual visitation. There's testimony about all of that. Appellant did not follow up on any of that for a significant period of time. And did not take advantage of the opportunity provided to him to get himself involved in the children's lives and put himself in the position of being a parent. So the department did offer reasonable efforts in the sense of, you know, tracking his chemical health programming, offered a parenting assessment. Even if the department hadn't done that, we really need to look at appellant's failure to do anything at all in the sense of putting himself into a relationship with the children. And I think that's just very important and very, in many ways, dispositive of the department, of the issue of reasonable efforts. But again, the department worked on a case plan. There's testimony about that, provided him a case plan, engaged with him about that, and there's no evidence that anyone said that was not sufficient. So I think the department did provide reasonable efforts. The district court, there was evidence presented to the district court in support of the petition, and the district court made findings on that. So I think there is no error, even if the court were to get to the reasonable efforts. That is all I have, unless the court has further questions. I can't
see no other questions. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I'd like to first address opposing counsel's argument that seems to sort of be an actual notice argument, that father had actual notice of what was going on based on communications with the caseworker or potentially his counsel, and based on the fact that the proceedings had been ongoing for some time and he should have anticipated that there would be a permanency proceeding and a permanency hearing. I am not aware of any legal authority to support that actual notice or the scope of these hearings or the fact that child protection hearings or proceedings are different than others, that is enough to make service by publication sufficient, or service by publication as it occurred in this case sufficient. As I noted in, I believe, my reply brief.
Can I say, counsel, the case you cite to talk about reasonably likely, I can't remember the phrase to reach.
The reasonably calculated?
Right.
Sure.
I understood the argument to be tied with that. It's not a very tight standard, reasonableness, but wouldn't that be the basis, or that seems to be the argument made by a respondent that history is what makes it reasonably likely? What would be wrong?
Sure, and I understand that argument. However, I don't think that there's any legal authority to support this actual notice requirement. When we have service by publication, when we have service by any other means, they need to be served properly. I do note the, I believe it's the Thiel v. Stitch case in my reply brief that talks about the actual notice requirement only being sufficient in cases where service is made, it's substitute service at the individual's residence. Again, I'm not aware of any other authority that says that any sort of actual notice exception exists when it comes to service by publication. Certainly, it's not in the rule. Certainly, there is not any case law that I am aware of in the child protection context or elsewhere that addresses that, saying that that is sufficient. I would again go to the TRT case, which, as Your Honor noted, is not a fully developed case. However, in that case, the court did still look at whether the notice was reasonable. And in that case, the parent had appeared at the hearing prior. So it's to say that they should be aware, they should know, because they had perhaps participated in some way in the proceedings in the past, is still not sufficient when we are looking at that notice question and whether that is proper. Again, appellant contends in this case that it was not.
Ms. Beskow-Ward, so the county's response brief at page 6, it quotes the affidavit of publication, or it summarizes it by saying that the department had identified 4 prior addresses, 1 in Illinois, 1 in Las Vegas, and 2 in Minnesota. And the 2 in Minnesota were the most recent. Isn't that, you know, a sufficient basis for the county to have made their unilateral decision to serve by publication in Minnesota as opposed to the other places?
Because we had 2 addresses in the affidavit of service from Minnesota?
Right, yeah, 2 in Minnesota, and they were the most recent. Apparently, I mean, there are dates associated with his presence in the state, apparently, or with his addresses, and those were the most recent addresses, at least in the affidavit.
Sure, and I would say looking a little bit further than the affidavit, we have the TPR petition that was filed approximately 2 weeks before this affidavit of service was filed on March 1st, I believe. The petition was February 15th approximately, and in that petition, it says that father is reportedly living out of state. So, and that is how the section on father kind of opens. He's reportedly living out of state. So the department seems to be aware that he's not living in Minnesota at this time. Yes, the affidavit says there are 2 addresses from the past that he was in Minnesota at some point in time. But based on the other facts and looking a little bit further than that, it seems to contradict that he could possibly be in Minnesota at the time. So I don't believe that that is sufficient to get over that hurdle. And as Your Honor noted, it was a unilateral decision, one that needs to be made by the district court under the rule, and that was not followed here. That, too, I believe makes it defective. I would also just like to very briefly address the reasonable efforts. It is a sufficiency of the evidence question that is properly before this court. It did not need to be addressed in the district court for it to be properly here. As Your Honor noted, Rule 21 makes that clear, as does the SSW decision. Because the notice was deficient here and because there is not sufficient evidence of reasonable efforts, we'd ask this court to reverse the order terminating father's parental rights and remand to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to both counsel for your briefing and arguments here today. Because of the juvenile matter, we have an expedited ruling within 45 days. Have a good day.